Blog Talk Radio.
Peace and greetings, family, brother. You see, Cooper. Again, we're trying to develop a Monday audience, and we're trying to give, you know, something very solid when we use our Mondays for rerun. And so, you know, I was fortunate, we blessed to have Christian Waters, you know, with a lot of the people that are teaching are moving us into trust and equity and learning trust, equity, and learning the laws and the syntaxes of equity. So we've been very, very blessed to have, as we run, some of Christian Waters' stuff to teach us some of that. But I want to remind people, also, tomorrow we have Spiritual Reach and Earth Magic. That's our holistic health folks. On Wednesday we have Sister Robina, and that's more of a women's base of astrology with men. And the sister goes in, very heavy sister. Thursday is Rod Cool, Cosmophysician Radio. You know, that brother's been going in truly when you want to know about history and history and how it's overlaid over time with the stars. Very seriously, you know, check out Brother Raku. And then this Friday, we have Brother Eddie, a numerologist who is blessed, you know, that he visits us. He's on Truth to Power Beverly D show, but he's going to come in and go on some stuff. And these brothers have been predicting some stuff through the numbers that is worth listening to, Brother Eddie. But right now, I'm going to give you Brother Christian Waters going in on our third episode of Brother Christian Waters on Trust and Equity.
These documents and our show recordings are incomplete and void without this notice agreement being attached herein by reference and a breach of this agreement. Upon breach of this agreement, the breaching party becomes liable for commercial damages of $200 million or more per stultification or impairment, per Christian Waters' discretion. Thank you for your understanding. So now for the revival of the study of equity, and what is equity? We go to John Bouvier's Institutes of American Law, where he wrote in 1882 in Volume 2, Section 3724, Paragraph 4, what equity was. Quote, law is nothing without equity, and equity is everything, even without law. Those who perceive what is just and what is unjust only through the eyes of law never see it as well as those who behold it with the eyes of equity. Law may be looked upon in some manner as an assistance for those who have weak perception of right and wrong, in the same way that optical glasses are useful for those who are short-sighted or whose visual organs are deficient. Equity, in its true and genuine meaning, is the soul and spirit of the law. Positive law is construed and rational law is made by it. That's what we've lost today. We've lost the soul and spirit of the law. We've lost the substance in which the law was based. We don't have any understanding of what equity is because it is the source of the law. So remember, it doesn't matter how many people don't believe it. What matters is whether it's true or not. Be sure what you're believing or what you're relying on, whether it is true or not. But you can't believe a lie and make it true. You can be believing a lie, thinking it is true. We need a definition of public versus private, because this is one of my pet peeves, that most people do not understand what is public, what is private. Even people who've been here for a long time. And that definition of private is any relation that you imply or express which is your intent as a special one. Next question I always ask is, when did you ever express your intent to form any relation as a special one? And the answer to that is really never, because you just can't say this is a special relationship. No, it doesn't work that way. That's not how you form a special relation. So then consequently, all your relations are then all public, even the ones that you think are private, like you're having a private conversation between your neighbor across the fence. And you think there's nobody standing around there between you and him, and that's it. And you think that's a private relation. Everything defaults to public today, automatically. Do nothing, and everything is public by default. Don't do it right, it's still public by default. And what is this special relation? How do we get one? How do we form one? Well, that's what NTT is all about, New Trust Technology. How to form a special private relationship that is private, not just because you say it is. That's the difference. Because that brings in the doctrine of election, that when you have multiple choices of two or more, the thing that you elect or the thing that you choose weighs all the rest. It becomes the substitute for all the rest. See Section 461 on Pomeroy. So unless you did something specially, you have no special relation. And what would that special thing be based on? Well, NTT, that's what we've been talking about for the last 4 years. Trust, private trust, special trust. Next we'll go to the Special Court of Appeals of Maryland, LGVA versus Belvale Farms, 2011 case. Where it talks about the manifestation of the intention that controls and not the actual intention. the manifestation of intention, or the actions and the deeds that are created. That's what controls, and not the actual intention. That would be, the actual intention would be saying, oh, this is a private relation. No, that's not what controls. It's the records or the deeds that are written down on a piece of paper, creating a record that manifests your action. That's what controls. What documents do you have to say that you formed a private relation? Then consequently, all your relations are then public by default. Quote from the case, it is to be noticed that an express trust may arise even though the parties in their own mind did not intend to create a trust. Now that right there brings in trust law. Restatement and second on trust law. Comes directly out of trust law. No party in a trust needs to know a trust is being formed. Comes right out of Gilbert's law and trust also. Ain't nothing new, folks. Just don't know about it. We're perishing for a lack of knowledge. Everything is a trust today. Contracts are just superficial disguises. Everybody thinks it's all contract. No, it's not contract. It's trust. So it is to be noticed that an express trust may arise even though the parties in their own mind did not intend to create a trust. It is the manifestation of intention that controls and not the actual intention. Where that differs from the manifestation of intention. An express trust may be created even though the parties do not call it a trust and even though they do not understand precisely what a trust is. It is sufficient if what they appear to have in mind is, in its essentials, what the courts mean when they speak of a trust. If you study trust law, you'll find out that a true private trust is in one of the main heads of the equity jurisdiction. It's one of the three main heads under the original jurisdiction. So it's not the manifestation of intention, or it is the manifestation of intention that controls. It's not the actual intention. It's the records, the deeds, the actions. And a deed is nothing more than a record of what you did in the past, put down on a piece of paper. And that piece of paper, we call it a deed. And we think that that deed, after it's been certified, is a title of ownership. No, it's just a record of the deed or the action that was done. It was when you assented to the agreement or assented to the transaction, so to speak, that that's when it became done in equity. And we were really doing equity all the time because that's the assent. Now on to Adam's quote from The Origin of English Equity. He quotes that we may confidently assert that equity and common law originated in one and the same procedure, that during the first 200 years of their history, they were not distinguished from one another. In other words, to everybody back then, it all looked the same. But today, that's what everybody's confused on. They think they want the unwritten part of the common law. And what they really want by definition is they want equity. But they don't know that equity is distinguished from common law. There's where they're slipping, because the major knowledge is missing of what they really want. And they think they want common law. No, you want equity, because equity is what's fair, just, and right. And then you ask any common law people, they say, oh, that's the common law. That's the unwritten part of common law. Well, the unwritten part of common law is really equity, because that's what's fair, just, and right by definition. That's the definition of equity. So what you really want is equity, not the common law, because equity created the common law. So for the first 200 years of their history, they were not distinguished from one another. And that, if we now distinguish between them during that period, we do it artificially, by the applications of tests impossible to contemporaries. It is well on to the 14th century before we get any clear distinction between equity and the common law. They finally became enlightened and figured out what created the common law. those equitable principles. In fact, equity creates all law. The law is derived from equity. It's a law unto itself. It is the priority law. So you got to be careful when you define law, what are you talking about as being law? And are you excluding equity in your definition? I look at equity as being like a single sheet of paper. The top side, the priority side, that's the equity side. It's face up. Every sheet of paper has got a back side underneath. That back side, that underneath, is the secondary part. It's the common law or the Ten Commandments. It's the judgment side of the top side, the equity principle, when you don't do them. So the top side, equity, created the bottom side, judgment law. What's the real law? Well, the top side is the unwritten part. But that unwritten, by definition, doesn't mean that it's never written anywhere. No, it's just not written in the record, say the statutes and codes. And it can't be, because it's not a part of that law. It's separate. It's segregated. But its principles are far-reaching. They intermingle with the common law or the laws, the statutes and codes. It's what created them. Another way of looking at it would be like a stick. Stick's got two ends. You look at a stick off of a tree, usually one end is bigger than the other. The bigger end, that's the priority side, that's equity. The smaller end, that's the legal side. They're all one stick. It's all so-called law. But what kind of law are you talking about? And which one has priority? And that's what this whole thing of NTT has led us to. A deeper understanding of what law really is, what derives law, what is law, which law has priority, and it comes back down to the application of a trust is in equity, which is the creator of all law, like I read in Bouvier's quote. And when you have the understanding of Bouvier and what we've been teaching here, you've got everything in place. Two of them cannot be separated, but yet they are. Now, like, scratch your head and say, well, how can that be? How can they be one, but yet segregated, not one? It's relative. It's relative from your point of view. How are you viewing it from? Are you viewing it from the at-law side? Then you will say that equity has no part of law. The law, statutes and codes, common law, thinks it's superior. It's in its own little playpen in the sandbox, like a little kid stomping its feet saying, I'm the big shot here. Well, in your little legal realm, yeah, that's right, because equity is not in there. But from the other point of view, standing over an equity, like the adult, instead of the kid side, and the adult now says, okay, Johnny, yeah, you're right over there. You've got your little realm. And you're king over there. But I'm the adult, and I know that equity rules over your little sandbox. If we ever got in conflict between that, I'm the one that's always going to win out. Equity's always going to win out. So little Johnny over there in the sandbox doesn't know anything about equity, but when he grows up, he'll put the eyes of equity on, and he will see the law, equity, in a different light. He will realize that he is playing in the playpen on the flip side of the paper, the bottom side, the secondary relationship. But the primary relationship, the most important, the one that has priority, is the top side, and that's the equity side. he will realize that he's on the small end of the stick, and he really wants to be over on the other side on the big end of the stick. And when you're over in the big end of the stick, looking at all that you see in your domain, you get a far clearer picture of how law is digested and understood. So put the eyes of equity on, like Bouvier's talks about, and you will see law differently. You will see its object and its purpose. And you will see that they are connected, but yet they are separate. You will see that one has priority over the other, and the other one is secondary. It's not the primary relation. And you will see it all in a different light, and you will have a far greater understanding. And then you can get out of the sandbox. We left off in 872, Objects and Purposes, in a new section, starting on Actual Fraud, Section 3. And that's on page 1552 in the book, or section, let's see, page 717 in the actual PDF. Section 872, Objects and Purposes. Fraud, in some of its phases, has long been an occasion for the exercise of jurisdiction both at law and in equity. Now, right there, it's like, that just tells you that there are two jurisdictions, that there's the two sticks, the big end of the stick and the little end of the stick. But you get to choose which jurisdiction you want to go into. If you go sign a contract, you just chose the legal side. But in reality, this is an executory contract. That's how equity looks at it. And they always come in pairs. And executory contracts are synonymous. They are a trust. They're the same as a trust. They're two trusts. And equity looks at this contract differently. It looks at it as an executory contract, two trusts. So the exercise of the jurisdiction is really controlled by you because you signed the contract, say for the mortgage to get the house. You signed a DC contract, debtor-creditor contract. Or you agreed to pay with fiction money that has no value and work your butt off all your life paying for a mortgage that you gave the house to them when you registered and recorded it. And you're the trustee on a trust. Go check your deed out. Who's the grantor and who's the grantee? So the exercise of jurisdiction is really controlled by you, but that's not where it ends. You could come back in and express the trust and say, there's another side to this executory contract. But that's inequity. There's the two sides, the DC side, the front side of the paper. The bottom side of the paper and the top side, equity, the other executory contract in the private side, priority side. So these, the various reliefs on the ground of fraud which are possible from the nature of the legal and the equitable modes of procedure and remedies are the following. At law, number one, the affirmative relief of rescission, whereby the defrauded party is permitted to rescind the contract or the transactions, or more accurately, to treat it as rescinded, to restore himself thereby to his original position of right by means of an appropriate action to recover back the money or other property which he had been deprived or which he had been parted with. And two, the affirmative relief whereby the defrauded party suffers the transaction to stand and by the action recovers pecuniary damages as compensation for the injury sustained by him from the deceit. So as soon as I see pecuniary damages, that's money relief. And as soon as it's money, I know that that really can't be equity, can't be true equity. Money does, you don't go for damages for money. So three, the defensive relief whereby the party sets up the fraud as a defense and thereby defeats any action brought to enforce the apparent fraudulent obligation. Now, in equity, number one, the affirmative relief of cancellation whereby the defrauded party procures an instrument, obligation, transaction, or other matter affecting his rights and liabilities to be set aside and annulled, and himself to be restored to his original position of right, as a consequence to reestablish his title, or to recover possession and the enjoyment of the property, and two, the affirmative relief of reformation by which the written instrument is corrected and perhaps re-executed when through fraud of the other party. It failed to express the real relations which existed between the two parties. Number three, the affirmative relief of pecuniary recovery where the liability arose from the fraud of the other party and no cancellation is necessary as the foundation of the recovery. Four, defensive relief, whereby a fraud is set up by way of defense to defeat any suit brought to enforce an apparent obligation or liability. In the decisions of the present in the following sections, I propose in the first place to describe the nature of fraud in equity, actual and constructive, to explain the essential elements entering into the conception of it, to define its kinds and classes, to enumerate its most important instances, and to show the various forms which it originally assumes in the affairs of mankind. I think Gibson's wrote, it's the badges of fraud are the signposts indicating that it's present. Continue on the text. In the second place, I shall describe the equitable jurisdiction occasioned by fraud, define its extent and limits, explain the principles which regulate its exercise, and enumerate the important instances of its exercise and the various reliefs, affirmative and defensive, which are thereby granted. The full treatment of some of these peculiar reliefs, such as cancellation and reformation, is postponed to a subsequent chapter. This discussion deals with fraud in equity and will only refer incidentally and by way of illustration to fraud at law. Wherever amounts of fraud according to legal conception, it is also fraud in the equitable conception, but the converse of this statement is not true. Yeah, I wonder why. And maybe it should be. You know, I don't see why at law cannot recognize equity. It just chooses not to. You know, if everybody realized that equity is where they should be, there'd be no need for law. If everybody was doing things equitable, and the first maxim coming into equity, he who comes into equity must be doing equity. But do we come into this world doing equity? No, we're trained by our parents to be inequitable brats, and we grow up as inequitable brats. But the converse of this statement is not true. The equitable theory of fraud is much more comprehensive than that of law and contains elements entirely different from any which enter into the legal notion. Like, equity's got an opposite way of thinking and looking at things. It gets right down to the heart of the matter and cuts through all the stupid forms, process, and procedures and technicalities. One of the technicalities would be, oh, judge doesn't have a signed oath. He's not a judge. Well, no. Was he intended to be a judge sitting on the bench? Yes. Okay, equity looks at that and says, he's a judge. But legal would say, no, he's got to have this, he's got to have that. Now you know why these judges sit on the bench, even without their forms that are technical, and they don't have them completed. Gives you an indication of how the courts are really, truly operating. They're still on the bench, and they should be. Next section, 873. Description, essential elements. It is utterly impossible to formulate any single statement which shall accurately define the equitable conception of fraud. It is utterly impossible to formulate any single statement which shall accurately define the equitable conception of fraud and which shall contain all the elements which enter into that conception. These elements are so various, so different under the different circumstances of equitable cognizance, so destitute of any common bond of unity, or you could put common law there, that they cannot be brought within any general formula. To attempt such a definition would therefore be not only useless, but actually misleading. It's been shown in the former chapter, footnote 1, that the jurisdiction of Chancery was originally rested upon two fundamental notions, equity and conscience or good faith. So equity and conscience, 1, and 2, good faith. They're equated. They're equal. The first of these embraced all the cases where a party acting according to the rules of the law and not doing anything contrary to conscience or good faith might obtain an undue advantage over another, which, though strictly legal, equity would not permit him to retain. The second embraced all those cases where a party, although perhaps still keeping within the limits of the strict law, so as to be sustained by the law courts, had committed some unconscious act or breach of good faith and had thereby obtained an undue advantage over another, which advantage, even though legal, equity would not suffer him to retain. The relief given by equity in all cases of fraud is plainly referable to this second head of the original jurisdiction. I've gone over that many times. Three heads of equity. First one was trust. Second was fraud, mistake, and surprise. And the last one was, been a while. Anyway, every fraud in most general and fundamental conceptions consists in obtaining an undue advantage by means of some act or omission which is unconscientious or a violation of good faith in a broad meaning given to the term by equity. Bona fides of the Roman law. Furthermore, it is necessary part of this conception that the act or omission itself by which the undue advantage is obtained should be willful. In other words, should be knowingly and intentionally done by the party, but is not essential in the equitable notion, although it is in the legal, that there should be a knowledge of and an intention to obtain an undue advantage which results. So it's like, you know, equity looks at it as being white and at law looks at it as being black. And we always have this way of interpreting things that are completely opposite. The willfulness of the act or omission is the element which distinguishes fraud from other matters by which an undue advantage may be obtained so far to furnish an occasion for equitable jurisdiction. Thus, it has been shown that an accident in an occurrence essential or external to the parties happens without any intent or other mental condition, and an undue advantage thereby accrues to one of them. The mistake, there is indeed a mental condition or a conviction of the understanding, but it wholly results from the ignorance or misapprehension and prevents the free action of the will, and there is therefore a complete absence of willfulness or intention in the true and legal meaning of those terms. In all phases of fraud, on the other hand, there is a mental condition, a conviction of the understanding, a free operation of the will, and the intention to or omit the very act by which the undue advantage is obtained. The following description is perhaps as complete and accurate as can be given so as to embrace all the varieties recognized by equity. Fraud in equity includes all willful or intentional acts, omissions, and concealments which involve a breach of either legal or equitable duty. Trust or confidence and are injurious to another or by which an undue or unconscientious advantage over another is obtained. So either legal or equitable duty. You know, equity can see both legal and equity. Law cannot see equitable. That's the problem with the law. That right there sets up a conflict. That is your conflict. It's like looking at an orange. You see half the orange. You have to turn it around 180 degrees to see the other side. It's like equity sees both sides. It's like superior way of looking at things. It looks at the equitable notions, and it also sees the legal notions. So which involve a breach of either legal or equitable duty, trust or confidence, and are injurious to another, or by which an undue or unconscientious advantage over another is obtained. Footnote 2. This general statement, to which I added the necessary terms will fulfill willful or intentional, is given slightly varied by Mr. Fountainblow. Case there, adopted by Judge Story in One Story's Equitable Jurisprudence, Section 187, where Mr. Carr on Fraud and Mistakes, in Section 42, is plain that the definition sometimes given by text writers and judges in which artifice, trick, subterfuge, circumvention, cunning, and the like terms are employed as necessary ingredients of fraud are inaccurate and misleading when applied to the equitable conception and are not even appropriate in describing fraud at law. It would also be very improper to include, quote, an intent to deceive as one of the essential elements of fraud and equity. The proposed Civil Code of New York gives the following definition of fraud as affecting the and entering into contracts, which are adopted by the present Civil Code of California. These definitions, according with the plan of these codes, embrace both fraud and equity at law. Actual fraud, within the meaning of this chapter, that is, on contracts, consists in any of the following acts committed by a party to that contract, or with his contrivance, which intend to deceive another party thereunto, or to induce him to enter into a contract. Number one, the suggestion that as a fact of that which is not true, by one which does not believe it to be true, and two, the positive assertions in a manner not warranted by the information of the person making it, and of that which is not true, although he believes it to be true, and three, the suppression of that which is true by one having knowledge or belief of that fact, and four, the promise made without any intention of performing it, any other act fitted to deceive. Contract fraud consists of, number one, in any breach of duty which, without an actual fraudulent intent, gains an advantage to the person in fault or anyone claiming under him by misleading the another to his prejudice or to prejudice any one claiming under him, and two, any such act or omission as the law specifically declares to be fraudulent without respect to actual fraud. These codes give a further and somewhat different definition of fraud or deceit as ground to an obligation imposed by law and of a legal action for damages. Before we go back into the text, I think we might look at footnote 1, which we missed. We'll go back into the text then. Our next section, 874. Four forms and classes of fraud and equity. In the leading and celebrated case of Earl of Chesterfield versus Jansen, Lord Hardwicke, while not attempting to formulate any general definition, ranges all the forms of fraud recognized by equity into four classes, a division based upon their intrinsic qualities, as which has been followed by nearly all subsequent writers and judges, probably because of what I read under the Adams quote. They were beginning to see that the common law and equity were distinct. That's the problem with Blackstone. He had no equitable understanding. So a division based upon their intrinsic qualities, which has been followed by nearly all subsequent writers and judges. These classes are, number one, frauds which are actual, arising from facts and circumstances of imposition, two, frauds apparent from an intrinsic nature and subject of the bargain itself, and three, frauds presumed from the circumstances and conditions of the parties, and four, frauds which are an imposition and deceit on third persons, not parties to the transaction. Footnote 1. Earl Battle of Chesterfield versus Chanson. In his most instructive opinion, Lord Hardwicke said upon this particular subject, "This court has an undoubted jurisdiction to relieve against any species of fraud, first, then fraud, which is dolus malus and may be actual, arising from the facts and circumstances of the imposition, which is the plainest case. Secondly, it is apparent from the intrinsic nature and subject of the bargain itself, such as no man in his senses would not, under delusion, would make on one hand, as to no honest and fair man would accept on the other, which are inequitable and unconscientious bargains. A third kind of fraud is that which is presumed from the circumstances and conditions of the party contracting, and this goes further than the rule of law, which is that it must be proved, not presumed. But it is wisely established in the courts to prevent any serendipitous advantage to the weakness or necessity of another, which knowingly it would do is equally against conscience as to take advantage of his ignorance. And a fourth kind of fraud, which should be collected and inferred in the consideration of this court from the nature and circumstances of the transaction as being an imposition to the deceit on other persons, not parties, to the fraudulent agreement. And this may sound odd, that the agreement may be infected by being a deceit or others not parties, but there has been relief. Of this kind have been marriage broken contracts, neither of the parties therein being deceived, but they tend necessarily to the deceit of one party to the marriage and of the parent or the friend." And he had some further illustrations and explanations of this fourth class, and then says, quote, "that the last head of the fraud which has been relief is that which infects catching bargains with heirs, revision heirs, or expectants in the life of their fathers. These have generally been mixed cases compounded of all the several species of fraud, there being sometimes proof of actual fraud, which is always deceptive." And Lord Hardwicke explains plainly that does not intend in this last instance to add a fifth and distinct class. He is simply giving a special instance or form which may fall wholly or partially into one or more of the four preceding classes. Back into the text. Pursuance of the order, which seems to be simple and natural, I shall include and treat under the deception of actual fraud those cases which only belong to the first of these four classes. In all of them, there seems to be the essential distinction between actual and constructive fraud. There is the element of falsity in fact, and the knowledge of the falsity, and the intention to deceive in a modified and partial manner, at least, in equity, no less than in the law. The three other classes where there is no necessary element of falsity in fact, and the fraud which there of them seem arises rather from motives of expectancy and policy than from any intent of the parties. Footnote 2, where it states the following extract shows the opinion of one of the ablest and modern equity judges concerning the difference between actual fraud in equity as well as at law and constructive fraud. Malcombe's case, Lord Romney said, quote, "I must say that to treat such a transaction as fraud is, in my opinion, to confound moral principles and to introduce an element of great confusion into the doctrine of courts of equity, the fundamental principle of which, as regards frauds, as it appears to me, that nothing can be called fraud and nothing can be treated as fraud except an act which involves grave moral guilt. I feel strongly that I have frequently endeavored to point out the injurious consequences of allowing such expression to be used as equitable fraud, or that courts of equity will call fraud, or constructive fraud, when in fact no act has been done by anyone which involves moral culpability. The only exception that I am aware of is in the phase constructive fraud that sometimes has been applied to cases where an innocent partner has been made liable for fraudulent acts of his co-partner. The expression is not a proper one even there, because innocent parties have been guilty of no fraud, but he is in many cases properly made liable for the compounded to redress and wrong committed by his really fraudulent co-partner. We observe that this opinion of Lord Romney is opposed to that of very many equally able judges, and in one important particular, it conflicts with direct decisions. It is finally settled that at law, there can be no fraud without moral culpability. But in equity, even actual fraud may exist without the knowledge and wrongful intent which constitutes the immorality at law. Furthermore, the phrase constructive fraud or equitable fraud has been constantly used by the courts from the earliest days, and it would produce great confusion to refuse the name fraud as to acts which have heretofore constituted constructive fraud, and to describe them by some other terms. The settled terminology of the law is one of the most important features, although this division is not followed by all writers. An example, Story and Snell. Yet actual and constructive in equity are separated by a very clear and certain line. The essential facts in actual fraud is untruth, and in the law it must be willful, a falsehood. Inequity may be, but is not necessarily willful. Constructive fraud, there is no necessary untruth. The equitable conception of constructive fraud embraces a great variety of transactions in which are absolutely void from illegality. Others are voidable. Others are still simply have a presumption against their validity and require affirmative proof of their fairness. A constructive fraud, the invalidity arises from the general motives of policy, good morals, and fair dealing, and not from the fact of untruth. Back into the text. Next section, 875, Nature of Actual Fraud. Although it is not possible to give any complete definition of fraud, yet it is possible to describe the various elements which are essential to the conception of actual fraud. In the vast majority of instances, actual fraud occurs in negotiations or dealing which are incidents of some agreement, executed or executory, even in transactions which are not agreements, which, as the execution of the will, the operation and the effect of fraud are the same as the case of agreements. And there are undoubtedly some special transactions capable of being affected by fraud, which cannot readily be brought within this general description, as, for example, the fraudulent obtaining of a judgment at law. And these special cases will be considered by themselves. And with all these varieties of external form, actual fraud in the numerous agreements, transactions, and dealings of mankind may, in its intrinsic nature, be reduced to two essential forms, false representation and fraudulent concealments. Suggestio falsi and suppressio veri. The question of actual fraud mainly consists, therefore, in analyzing the two forms and in determining their necessary constituents. Next section, 876, first, misrepresentations. A misrepresentation, in order to constitute fraud, must contain the following essential elements. Number one, its form as a statement of fact. And two, its purpose of inducing the other party to act. And three, its untruth. And four, the knowledge or belief of the party making it. And five, the belief, trust, and reliance of the one whom it is made. And six, its materiality. These elements will be examined separately. Next section, 877. Number one, the form, an affirmation of the facts. Misrepresentation must be affirmative statement or affirmation of some fact in contradistinction to concealment or failure to disclose, or a mere expression of opinion, footnote 1. States in Jennings versus Broughton, which brought to set aside a sale of shares with certain mine on account of misrepresentations of the vendor, Knights Bruce, L.J., stating the requisites of misrepresentation, said on page 130, first, in the statements of representations concerning the mine, was there any untrue assertions material in its nature, that is to say, which taken as true added substantially to the value or promise of the mind and was not actually conjectural or merely. He cites to support that after that. To the text. The majority of instances was made by means of language written or spoken, but it may consist of conduct alone, of essential acts, when through his instrumentality it is intended to convey the impression or to produce the conviction that some facts exist and such result is the natural consequence of the acts. Footnote 2. States that it was so held in Lovell versus Hicks, where fictionous and fraudulent experiments were performed so as to induce the party to enter into a contract concerning the patent right. In this case, the point has been illustrated by Denny versus Hancock, although the decision was rested upon misconception rather than fraudulent misrepresentation. A purchaser so misled as to the boundaries by the occurrence of the grounds that the contract was not enforced. There was, of course, a mistake of his, but the mistake consisted of his obtaining from the appearance of an impression which was natural, but at the same time contrary to the real fact. The appearance thus operated as a misconception. When two parties have made an agreement and has reduced it to writing, one of them knowingly alters it in the material manner and procures the other to execute or to accept the writing in ignorance of the alteration. This conduct is fraud. Back into the text. Misrepresentation of the law is not considered as amounting to fraud because it is generally said all persons are presumed to know the law. It is not perhaps to be added that such a statement would rather be an expression of an opinion than the assertion of the fact. Footnote 3. Edgefield versus Marquis of Londonderry, two other cases, where it had been shown that the preceding section, that when a party has been led to an act in ignorance of or mistake of the law, though the inequitable conduct of another, or through the inequitable conduct of another, may be relieved on the ground by mistake. See ante sections 847. Text. Statement of intention merely cannot be a misrepresentation amounting to fraud, since such a statement is not the affirmation of any external fact, but is, at most, only an assertion that a present mental condition or opinion exists. Footnote 4. This is Bank versus National Bank. After that, it must not be understood that no rights would flow from such a statement. A representation of the future intention, absolute in form, deliberately made for the purpose of influencing the conduct of the other party and then acted upon by him, is generally the source of a right and may amount to the contract, enforceable at such by a court of equity. He cites the support after that. Back into the text. That the fact, however, concerning which the statement is made is future does not of itself prevent the misrepresentation from being fraudulent. The statement of matter in the future, if affirmed as a fact, may amount to a fraudulent misrepresentation as well as a statement of the fact as existing at present. Footnote 5. Piggott versus Stratton. Lord Chancellor Campbell said that the doctrine is well established that if A deliberately makes an assertion to B, intending to be acted upon by B, it is acted upon by B, A is a stop from saying that it is not true. If it turns out to be false, A is answerable to the damage which may occur to B, and B is entitled in respect to anything done to the belief that was true to object to any denial of its truth by A. versus Rosetta, two other cases. Case here last noted under Fortue versus Godin. Some of these cases may refer to the doctrine of equitable estoppel, but it is in plain that where the representation is that the fact in the future and is not a mere promise, is a relief upon and turns out to be false, the rights and remedies of the injured party are the same as those which arise from the fraudulent misrepresentation of the existing fact. And there is nothing inconsistent with the result with the rule that no equitable estoppel arises from the mere promise. Section 878, misrepresentations of matter of opinion. Since the very cornerstone of the doctrine is that of statement must be an affirmation of a fact, it has sometimes been said, but very incorrectly, that the misrepresentation cannot be made of a matter of opinion. The true rule is that a fraudulent misrepresentation cannot itself be a mere expression of an opinion held by the party making it. The reason is very simple. While the person addressed has a right to rely on an assertion of the fact, he has no right to rely upon the mere expression of an opinion held by the party addressing him. In whatever language such expressions be made, he is assumed to be equally able to form his own opinion and to come to a correct judgment in respect to the matter, as the party from whom he is dealing, and cannot justly claim, therefore, to have misled by the opinion, however erroneous it may have been. Footnote 1. I wonder why the judges at law always give an opinion. So for this reason, the general praise of this wire, of his own wares by the seller, commonly called puffing, for the purpose of enhancing them in the buyer's estimation, has always been allowed, provided it is kept within reasonable limits. That is, provided that the phrase is general and the language is not positive affirmation of the specific fact affecting the quality so as to express warranty and not the intentional assertion of a specific and material fact known to the party to be false and so as to be a fraudulent misrepresentation. The foregoing rule as an expression of the opinion cannot be pushed beyond the plain reasons upon which it rests, wherever the statement, although relating to the matter of opinion, is the affirmation of the fact. It may be fraudulent representation. Such an affirmation might be made in several forms. The very fact concerning which the statement is made may be the existence of an opinion. The existence of an opinion may be a fact material to the proposed transaction, and the statement that such an opinion exists becomes an affirmation of the material fact, and if untrue, it is a misrepresentation. The opinion might either be represented as held by a third person or to be held by a party, by the very party making the statement. As a single illustration, either the third person or the party himself might be an expert, and their opinion might be material, so that the representations that the opinion was held might be the affirmation of the most material fact. Still another and perhaps more common form of such misrepresentation, wherever a party states a matter which might otherwise be an opinion, and does not state it as a mere expression of his own opinion, but affirms it as an existing fact material to the transaction, so as the other party may reasonably treat it as fact and rely and act upon it as such, then the statement clearly becomes an affirmation of fact within the meaning of the general rule and may be fraudulent misrepresentation. The statements which most frequently come within this broad, this branch of rule are those concerning value. Foregoing distinctions which I have attempted to explain and which have sometimes been lost sight of will go far, I think, to harmonize whatever apparent conflict of decision may be found in some of the reported cases. Footnote 3. Interesting that it says concerning value up here. Statements which most frequently come within the branch of the rule are those concerning value. Value is looked at differently between at law and equity. Value on the at-law side is reduced to a dollar value. And what's a dollar? A dollar has no value, according to the U.S. Treasury website. But on equity, what is the value of something? Well, the value is mine. It has no limit. It's all mine. Somebody owns it. not relatable to dollars. It's not in the dollar realm. It's not in the public realm. Footnote 3, cannot be denied there is an apparent and direct conflict decisions upon the effect of representations concerning value. The distinctions drawn in the term seem to be imperfect accordance with principle and to be just and practical, and they will lead to remove most of the conflict, which is apparent rather than real. Statements of value are sometimes nothing more than expression of the party's own opinion, and there is a group of decisions which they are so treated. On the other hand, statements of value may be affirmations of a specific material fact, and there is a group of decisions which are they are so treated and held to be fraudulent misrepresentations. There is no necessary conflict between these two groups of decisions, although the language of the judicial opinions are not always recognized and preserved as the distinction between the two forms. Haygrath versus Waring is directly in point with the sustained distinctions added or stated in the text of the full matter. The plaintiff had inherited a piece of land, and she was completely ignorant concerning it and its value. The defendant was well acquainted with it and with its value. He stated to her that it was not worth more than £100, and she therefore sold and conveyed it to him for that sum. It was really worth £500, which the defendant knew well. The suit is brought to set aside the sale and recover the land, and the relief was granted, although the objection was strongly urged that such a representation was merely a matter of opinion. The court first decided that no fiduciary relation existed between the two parties. Ha-ha. First thing they had to do. To decide that there was no fiduciary relation between the two parties. Now remember, all fiduciary relations are not trusts, but all trust duties are fiduciary. All trustees have a fiduciary relation, but not the other way around. But the first thing the court had to do was decide whether a fiduciary relation. In other words, the first thing that ties in with the Oklahoma case I talked about the last several, it's been a while. Where the first thing the court must do is, number one, determine the type of relationship pertaining to the case. That's what they're doing here. The court first decided that no fiduciary relation existed. They're looking for the type of relationship, which I always say, the relation is the key. What type of relationship are you dealing? Are you primary or secondary? What type of relation? Trust relationship or all the other relations not trust? All DC relations. Agent, the principal, etc. Anything that's not private relation, that's trust, is DC. That's why I classify it. Very simple to keep it simple. The court first decided that no fiduciary relation existed between the two parties, so that the case must depend upon general rules acceptable alike to all persons dealing with such other. Well, we want the special rules, the ones that apply to trust. If we have a trust that's private. Wickens VC said that independently of any fiduciary relation, this court holds that a person obtaining a conveyance of real estate on the faith of certain representations which are afterwards shown to be untrue must submit to the conveyance treatment as fraudulent and void against the person deceived. In this case, the representations which he made to her was at the value of the what she had was had the value she had to sell was about £100. This was not a mere purchaser's assessment, that is an estimate or an opinion, but a deliberate statement made to her by a person having full knowledge, which statement was asked by her for her guidance in the transaction and was acted upon by her in reliance on its good faith and honesty. See also Turner versus Harvey. A misrepresentation as to the amounts of indebtedness and a bunch of cases to support that. It's been held that statements as to the cost of property cannot be fraudulent misrepresentations entitling the injured party to a rescission if no fiduciary relation existed. Case cites to support that, Cooper versus Lovering. Last case, Holbrook versus Connor. Mr. Justice Dickerson has dissented, holding that as it seemed to be seems to me the more accurate and reasonable doctrine. Fowles versus Watson, the representation of the property cost $500,000 when it only cost half that account, was held a statement of fact and not a mere opinion. I'd support that. Graham versus O'Connor, a mere exaggeration of the value and excellence of the land was held a matter of opinion only. Text. Section 879, number 2, the purposes for which the representation was made. I think we'll pick up there next time. That's on section 879 on page 730 in the PDF or page 1565 in the book. That's section 879. We'll pick up there next time. So let's go to Q&A. Press star 8. State your name, where you're from. Press star 8 for Q&A. Raise your hand for getting in the queue line. Star 8. Star 8 to raise your hand for question. Star 8 to get in the queue line. Star 8, anybody? Question, anybody? Nope, nobody in line? Okay, we're going to end it quick tonight then. Sorry, going once. Anybody got a question? You better jump on now. Sorry, going twice. Anybody got a question? You better jump on now. Sorry, going last time.
Hey, how you doing, Christian? Hello? Hello?
Sorry, anybody? Question?
Hello? 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 Hello?
Hello, go ahead.
Hey, how you doing, Christian? This is Chris from Maryland.
Never mind.
Can you hear me, Christian?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I had a hypothetical situation. Say you had a foreclosure action coming against you. Although you had done a securitization and you know there's fraud in your contract. And you were being brought in as a defendant in state court, and you did a removal to federal court. Have people been successful invoking equity in the federal courts?
I don't know. I haven't studied the federal, and other than what I've just said through Rule 86 on federal.
Well, particularly in the jurisdiction where I'm at here, a lot of people have had, done a securitization and found fraud, and because the state court...
You know, are you the one that's hauled into the at-law side?
Someone I know, yes.
Okay, so there you are in the at-law jurisdiction. How far are you going to get with fraud over there?
Not far at all.
Not far at all.
Right.
So that's a problem. In order to get equity to look at it differently, you're going to have to get into court of equity, not at law.
Okay.
So I would stick to, in that scenario that you're proposing, instead of fraud, I'd be coming in under something very easy so they could jam up that thing or possibly even win, which would be go the discovery route, make them produce the documents that they rely on, give them standing. If they don't have those, in most states, they must have those at the filing, or else they couldn't give the court jurisdiction to give a ruling on.
Okay.
And if they didn't come back with the discovery, then you got to compel through the court, compel them to do that. And you got to get a court order signed by a judge. And when they don't produce, when they got a court order signed by the judge, then they're practically toast from that point on. If you know how to enforce and take it further, you can win solely at law, just what I just told you.
The discovery. Okay. Yeah.
I won
All right.
many times that way.
Yeah, you mentioned writing pleadings and winning, so in the past.
Yes, and then when a case goes away, because what they'll probably do is they'll withdraw the case voluntarily, and then everybody just has a big blast of air relief. But no, I will
come back
and tell the judge, you know, no, you can't let them dismiss this case. Because what they did was an inequitable discovery. They didn't come up, and they got caught with their pants down. Now, let's equate that to going through a stoplight. The cop catches you at it, writes you a ticket, and you tell the cop, oh, don't write me a ticket. I'll just go back here and go through the light properly.
Too late.
Same thing here. You got caught with your pants down. You don't have the documents to give the court standing. You're not the proper party to be in there, and you have prejudiced and damaged me. I would come back in and sue them for damages. And I would not allow them to leave the field of battle withdrawing without some kind of, what do the judges call it, sanctions.
Sanctions, okay.
You know, if we would be doing things like this, they would have the documents proper at the beginning instead of trying to get away with not having the correct thing. Now, all that I just told you is not done in equity. It's all done at law, all by the at-law rules, and you can win there by doing that. But the point is, even when you win, whether you pursue it afterwards or not, the thing is to go back up and study the equity part and come back in through the equity side, because that's where the priority is, that's where the superiority is, and that's where you want to be. You're coming back in with independent action, getting them for the whole ball of wax.
Right. Well, but if I want to go come back that way, then I can I still sue for damages on the at-law side and get the equity performance?
No. If you're in equity will give you the performance, what was due or such. And if it can't, then as an alternative, it will go slide into the at-law side and give you damages to make up some kind of compensation.
Okay, but I think in the past, too, you also mentioned that you could potentially do, you could go at them for like emotional stress or compensatory damages, I think.
Yeah, you could do that.
Instead of doing the fraud, and then you'd still be able to come back in equity and ask for the performance.
I'm not saying that you can't come at them of fraud, but to prove the fraud, especially at law, you're going to have, if you put it on a reverse, you would want to have a higher standard, and that's what it is. Fraud is a higher standard at law.
Higher standard, okay.
Yeah. And it's harder to prove. You've got to have your ducks all lined up in a row to get that. So I would pick something a little more easier, especially from the first timers. You know, everybody wants to claim fraud, and they think that's going to solve their problem. No. They better learn how to throw the softball first before they learn how to throw the fastball slider.
Well, a lot of people have had success down in this jurisdiction kind of doing what you just explained there is, but what they've had to do is pay for removal from the state court and move it to the federal court. Because it's like this corruption in state court down here. And then they've done the discovery to ask them to prove, you know, to produce the documents. So.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Just wanted to get your take on that. Appreciate everything you're doing and all the work you and your wife do. And I pray to God will continue to bless you and your wife.
Well, thank you for that. Coming on, Chris.
All right, thanks. Talk to you soon.
Who's next? Star 8, anybody? Star 8, raise your hand. star 8. Star 8, anybody? Got a clear board again. Going once. Star 8, going once. Star 8, going twice. Star 8, anybody? Last call. Star 8, anybody? Star 8, third time. Okay, that's a show. I would like to thank you all for coming and listening to me, and maybe you'll have some questions next week. So we'll see you all later. Everybody have a great week. Night all.